Jesus turned to the crowd and said, "Whoever comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, and yes, even life itself, cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry the cross and follow me cannot be my disciple." Now, this passage is what biblical scholars refer to as one of the hard sayings of Jesus. It is a party stopper. One can almost hear the DJ's needle scratch across the record. I still remember the very first time I read this passage. I was in my childhood bedroom in Paragould, Arkansas, reading the denim-covered Good News Bible I'd been given at third grade Sunday school graduation. That Jesus, meek and mild, would say such things confused me then and brought me to tears. I got out of bed, I found my mom, and I told her I would not hate her no matter what Jesus said. And my incredulity today is not much less than it was circa 1980. In a world in which hating one another seems ever more acceptable, in which disagreement becomes tantamount to a declaration of war, do we really need Jesus pushing us in that direction? What does Jesus mean here? Well, if ever a word study in New Testament Greek mattered, it does here. When in 21st century English we say hate, we mean something like mean-spirited disdain and hostility, a loathing that ultimately writes off the other as unworthy of our consideration or care. That is not what the word in Luke means today. Probably worth me saying again, that is not what the word in Luke means today. It would be out of Jesus' character and out of sync with the entire rest of the gospel of Jesus for him to commend us to hate in that sense. So what does Jesus mean? And is it important to us today? Well, for 14 chapters in Luke's gospel, Jesus has been proclaiming, and more importantly, living a way. He has shown grace and love and mercy when no one else would do so. He has denied custom. He has denied his own family when they sought to silence him and bring him home. He has even denied the law whenever these things sought to stifle his words and his actions of love and grace. 10 chapters ago, the people of Nazareth, among whom he was raised, even attempted to throw Jesus off a cliff and shut him up permanently. And yet, Jesus has continued to proclaim and live the way he knows is God's hope for the world. At each turn, he must leave behind someone or something that he has loved, that he still loves, in order to be faithful. Now consider this, and feel free to use this as a conversation starter with your more evangelical friends. By my count, in the entire Gospels, Jesus says to those around him, "Believe in me," twice. Two times in all the Gospels. By comparison to that, Jesus says, "Follow me," 22 times. In other words, discipleship, following Jesus, is exponentially more important to Jesus than belief. That's not my opinion. That's the repeated stress of Jesus' own preaching. And for my fellow grammar nerds, this is what's called the imperative case. It's a command of Jesus. What my mother used to call not an ask, but a tell. The way Jesus proclaims and walks, in other words, is not a way for him only. It is the way of God's hope for the entire world. It is the way anyone who claims Jesus is called to walk with him. Now, I read the Gospels a lot. You actually pay me to do so. And often when I study the Gospels, I sometimes try to imagine myself as various characters in the story, to picture in my mind's eye what the action would have been like from the participant's point of view. You should try that sometime. The only character off limits is Jesus. Don't imagine yourself as Jesus. If you feel tempted to imagine yourself as Jesus, please come see me. And if you ever hear me imagine myself as Jesus, please call Jill Thompson and let her know. As I engage in this exercise, I seem to return repeatedly to that buddy threesome from Capernaum who are constantly at Jesus' heels, Peter and James and John. They are, in Luke's gospel, the first three people who tether themselves to Jesus. Until Jesus meets those three on the banks of the Sea of Galilee, he's actually just a solitary preacher. But forever after he's met these three, he is a rabbi with disciples. Peter and James and John leave behind everything they've known in order to walk in Jesus' way. What would it have been like to be them? More specifically, how would Jesus' hard sayings today have struck them? And in order to know that, we need to look at a mountain and a garden. First, we need to go back five chapters in Luke's gospel to Mount Tabor, rising up from the Jezreel Valley. On a different, earlier day, Peter and James and John follow Jesus up that mountain. And on its summit, they have a collective epiphany. Jesus is transfigured before them. The veil drops. And for just a moment, Peter and James and John see the world as it truly is, without shadow and without illusion. It is the spiritual high of all spiritual highs. The three friends are awash in joy, and they're eager in their desire to do something, to respond to this gift in some big and profound way. Now, we may never have seen Jesus transfigured, but very many of us get it on some level. We too have had some mountaintop experience somewhere along the way. Maybe it was here in church. Maybe it was at a spiritual renewal weekend like Curcio or the Emmaus Walk. Maybe it was out in the grandeur of nature. Maybe it was at a vulnerable low point of your health. Or maybe it was sitting in quiet solitude over morning coffee. But regardless of the setting, we have felt so close to God, even if just for a moment, that encounter worked its way into the very marrow of us. It made us feel so good and loved and so accepted that the background radiation of that epiphany has lingered ever since. So much so that it may have come to define for us what our relationship with God is all about. It's what we want faith to be all about, a recurrence of that experience. And that feeling. Well, now fast forward 13 chapters in Luke's gospel, leapfrogging over today's hard saying at the halfway point. And Peter and James and John again find themselves alone with Jesus, but this time in a garden called Gethsemane. It's on the downslope of the Mount of Olives. Their encounter in the garden has none of the hallmarks of that earlier experience on Mount Tabor. Jesus is not transfigured this time. Rather, now Jesus is starkly, abjectly alone. Jesus has reached the destination in which walking in God's way has taken him, where his willingness to walk away from all the things in his world that push against God's hope has taken him. And in that garden, we are told that Jesus doubles over in anguish so intense that Luke says, quote, his sweat became like great drops of blood falling on the ground. In that moment, Jesus seems horribly, pitifully human. And the scene is worsened when the mob shows up and drags Jesus away from his friends. This is not the big and profound way that Peter and James and John had hoped, had believed that things would go. And suddenly, you see, discipleship is not academic. Suddenly, these three must decide if they can and will continue to walk the way of Jesus, the way of grace, in the face of everyone, the mob, Pilate, the Jewish leaders, their own families who pressure them otherwise. They'll hesitate. They'll falter. They will temporarily forget the joy and power of the Mount of Transfiguration as they are overwhelmed by the anguish and sorrow of the garden. Now, realizing that the way of grace requires sacrifice and discomfort and loss, in addition to feelings of warmth and joy, Peter and James and John must decide whether they will still walk the way of Jesus. So imagine yourself as Peter and James and John. And imagine the jarring disconnect between that high on the Mount of Transfiguration and that low in the Garden of Gethsemane. From rapturous joy to stunned and hollow sorrow. And only then return to a consideration of that hard saying in today's gospel. The Greek word for hate that appears in this saying of Jesus does not, it turns out, mean mean-spirited hostility. It means, rather, in the case of conflict between Jesus' call of discipleship and anything else, including our most cherished relationships in this world, followers of Jesus must choose the way of the gospel, which is always, always the way of love and grace. The hard lesson learned by Peter and James and John is that the gift of that heady and sublime experience on the mountaintop, which does indeed change us, is not given to us by God merely to uplift our spirits and buoy us through the world. How great would that be if that's all it were for? The mountaintop experience is given to us so that we will have the strength still to follow, still to be faithful, when pressure and sorrow and anguish that's around us and in us becomes so intense that we sweat like drops of blood. The mountaintop experience reveals to us that we are created in love and showered in grace. But it also compels us to live through love and to shower the world in grace always. and especially when the political and social and familial grain would have us do otherwise. The Garden of Gethsemane always eventually follows the Mount of Transfiguration. They are forever tethered in this broken world. We should rejoice in the mountain and thank God for it. But we must always remember that the mountaintop experience energizes and sustains us so that we have the strength to stay with Jesus through the garden. These days, the Garden of Gethsemane seems to have extended from the downslope of the Mount of Olives and out across the landscape of the whole world. These days, it is so easy to despair of so much hatred and selfishness and vitriol that we find ourselves sweating like drops of blood. But the world as God hopes it to be, it's also right here, just on the other side of the veil. We have seen it in glimpses. We have been empowered by the gift of that vision. And we are called to follow the way until the love and grace of God transfigure the whole world. Amen.